I hope some of you have heard our radio program. Any of you ever tuned in to Generations with Vision, KevinSwanson.com? Thank you. Thanks for tuning in. We used to do a lot of AM and FM stations, but they cost $30,000 to $40,000 a year. So we figured it'd be better if we just bribed you, gave you a pen or something, and tried to get you to download it on the internet. And if you do that, then it saves us $30,000 to $40,000 a year, and we appreciate your business. Our Generations radio broadcast has been going on for 10 years. It's Generations for a couple of reasons. One is my father does a lot of the research for the program. He sends me 7 or 8 ideas every day. And my son does most of the editing for the program. My daughter, Rebecca, is doing a lot of that too now. So it's a huge part of our family economy. This is really the family vision for our family, and it certainly is a generational vision. So that's, I guess, one of the reasons why we call it Generations. My father was a real pioneer in a lot of different ways. I love my father. He would have been on the first wagon train west if he had been living in the 1870s. In fact, he probably would have been on the first wagon of the first wagon train west. Just the kind of person that he was. In fact, that's maybe one of the reasons why they moved west in 1965 and then off to the mission field. I asked my dad why he went to the mission field when he came out to visit us a few years ago. I asked him why he went to the mission field in 1969, and he said that he wanted to preach the gospel to the Japanese, but there was something more fundamental that was working in his mind at the time. He had raised us out in the mission field in Japan, but he said that he was teaching in American public and private schools in the 1965, he moved on to the Christian school movement. Actually, he was influenced by R.J. Rushdoony in that whole Christian education movement of the early 1960s. Believe it or not, R.J. Rushdoony was speaking at conferences in Portland, Oregon, and other places. And most people forget the old man that saved the city. Has anybody ever heard the Ecclesiastes story of the old man that saved the city? He was a wise man, and everybody forgot who he was. That's typically the way it works. The people that really are there at the beginning, and they're the seminal ideas that are forming the Christian education movement in the 1960s and the home education movement in the 1970s and 80s, these guys are typically forgotten. But it's important for some of us, I think, to recognize what has been done. So my father got involved in the Christian schooling movement in the 1960s, but he came to the decision, he said, that by 1968 he did not want to raise his children in the American culture. So he decided to take us out to an island out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and raise us out there. And that's what happened. I know that decisions like these are radical decisions. At some points, I think there are fathers who get a vision and realize how bad things are. And I think for my father, it wasn't just the teaching of evolution. That was really significant for my dad, especially when he bought that first book, A Twilight of Evolution by Henry Morris in 1962, I believe it was. That was huge for my dad. Because he knew that if you would teach a child that he is nothing but cosmic dust floating around a universe of total chance, if you teach them that for year after year, decade after decade, eventually they will act out on those ideas and they will descend on Columbine High School with natural selection emblazoned on the t-shirt and wipe out 19 innocent citizens. Okay, this is the kind of thing that happens. Ideas have consequences. And my dad really thought that this inculcation of the naturalistic, materialistic idea, God's a non-issue, you are cosmic dust. You are cosmic dust. You work that into the fiber, into the brain of a child over 100 years, and you will make a difference, a serious difference in cultural and social situations. But my father also was concerned about the culture, the mass culture, and what was happening with the teen rebellion, which didn't exist in the 1880s, all right? Whatever you see today, this whole teen rebellion thing that happens in every youth group, every church, every school, every teen expected to rebel. This is a modern phenomena that non-believing sociologists talk about a lot. It's called the teenage phenomena. Came out in 1946, was about when it matured. And it's only been the last 60 years or so. And my father saw it. Now, almost nobody saw it in the 1960s and 70s. I mean, I have a hard time finding anybody who was raised in a household like mine. I feel like I'm blessed that God took me to an island and had me raised out there. There was such a transition going on in the 60s. I mean, the 50s was an issue, but by the time you get to the 60s, you know, the Beatles are still hanging out in church, and they're playing a whole lot of shaking going on in a piano out in England somewhere, and they pulled a band together, and they start to sing songs like "I Want to Hold Her Hand," but by the time you get to 1969, they want to do it in the road. So, I mean, there certainly was. Can everybody see there was a difference between 61 and 69? Can everybody see there's a difference now looking back? Can you see there's a difference in 1961, lazy, hazy, crazy days of summer in 1961, and 1969, and kids in Satan's service and everything else that came in the 70s? Can everybody see there's a difference? Maybe you can't see there's a difference. Well, can you see the difference in hair length for the guys, maybe? Maybe that help you at all? I'm just, you know, drugs, rock and roll, sex was really not the common thing in 1961, but it was in 69. Can everybody see that? Does everybody understand that there was a massive, massive social shift that occurred in the 1960s? So my father said, "Let's go to an island and raise our children out there." And not many fathers came to that decision in 1969. See, this is my point. If you're going to salvage your children in a hurricane, you're probably going to have to bolt them down to the deck of the ship. Well, something radical happened in our society, and it really had its roots back in the 1700s and 1800s. And, you know, one of the ways to really nail down what happened to the modern man was that modern man really became lost and lonely. This is probably the best way to define it. Modern man is lost and lonely. To really boil it all down, and Francis Schaeffer did a pretty good job when he did his best to try to analyze and boil down the problem. I don't think he got to the solution, but he did get to something of the problem in the 1940s and 50s and 60s. Here's a Christian philosopher who just sits there and he's trying to analyze, trying to think what's going on. Modern man is lost and lonely. He is lost without truth and lonely without relationships. Okay? That's it. Now, it's very difficult for you to step back, put yourself in a glass or under a microscope, and look at yourself and try to identify who you are and what have you become. What have you turned into? Who are you? Who are we? What have we become? This is incredibly difficult to do. Why? Because it's hard to get the frog out of the boiling water if he's been in the boiling water for 100 years and the delta T is 1 degree per year. Do you follow me? If you're a frog and the change in temperature is a degree a year and you're at 211 degrees in 2013, it's taken a long time to get there. The frog has no idea what's going on. No idea. There are those who make things happen. There are those who watch things happen. And there are those who wonder what happened. And most people wonder what happened because they have so little vision. Well, this is the issue. The issue is modern man cut himself off from the possibility of truth because he cut himself off from the possibility of God. Okay? So he's wandering around in Antarctica in a snowstorm, and he has no tether to anything. That's modern man. And so you have worldview ministries that have established themselves to restore truth to modern man. And let me ask you this question. Is that enough? If I said modern man has lost truth and relationships, would a creation ministry or a worldview ministry be sufficient to solve the problems of modern man? My answer is no, I don't think so. Now, I'm thankful for all of the worldview ministries, but let me tell you this. Modern man is lost and lonely in the postmodern world. He's lonely. There are 7 times more people by percentage living alone today than did at the turn of the 20th century. 7 times more by percentage. Now, what happened? And I will tell you what happened. It was Jean-Jacques Rousseau that happened. Jean-Jacques Rousseau is the father of the modern world. If you look around you and you see the institutions, the educational establishments, the socialist systems. See, people have asked what in the world happened to produce the world we have, where the average Western nation, 60 to 80% of the people's income is being consumed by governments at all levels. That has never occurred, as far as I know, in the history of mankind. In the Roman Empire, about the most they were ever able to tax the people was 7 to 8% of the people's income. Okay? Governments ran on 7 to 8% of the people's income at the most tyrannical height of the Roman system. So here today, in this wonderful country, where we are so free, we have so much freedom in America, it's about 60% government spending added up, local, state, and federal, divided by the gross national income, has risen from 8% in 1900 to roughly 60% today. Now, does anybody care why that happened? Does anybody wonder why it happened? I do. I mean, inquiring minds want to know. Like me. So why? Why? I mean, aren't you even remotely curious why this happened? I know it's very, very difficult to speak to people who have been in chains for a long time. As governments control more and more of life, man becomes more and more enslaved, this time not by local fiefdoms, but by large centralized governments. It was a big shift that occurred roughly around 1865. Does anybody down here remember what happened in that period of time where slavery shifted from local fiefdoms, which is pretty awful? I don't appreciate it at all. If the Son will make you free, you will be free indeed. By the way, read my section on Mark Twain and apostate, and I deal with this in detail. But we've moved towards these massive, centralized, draconian, tyrannical governments, and people hardly recognize it. Well, it all started with Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who wrote The Social Contract, and he was the father of the modern-day revolutions. He was the father of the modern world, modern education. And this is why I bring him up in most of the homeschooling conferences I speak at, because I want people to know. I think homeschoolers ought to be probably more curious than anybody else. They're not attending these schools, and hopefully they might be a little critical about these schools and see that there may be a little bit of a problem with governments controlling education all the way up to the Department of Education in Washington, D.C. And they should ask themselves how in the world this came about. And it came about through the work of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. He's the father of compulsory education. Does anybody know what compulsory education is? Have you ever tried not to school your children at 10 years of age? Try it out. Try it out in any state in America. My guess is you're going to get in trouble. Compulsory education didn't exist. Actually, it existed in a few little spots here and there. It happened somewhere around AD 67 in a place called Jerusalem, 3 years before that place fell apart. And there's a few times in history, some of the most awful periods of time in all of history, where compulsory education has come about. But it came about in the 19th century largely because of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Jean-Jacques Rousseau wrote a book called Emile, which was his book on how to educate a child in the modern age. And he toyed with the idea of fathers and mothers doing the job, and then concluded that it was impossible, and suggested that we ought to send these kids off to the state. In fact, this is what Will Durant says about Rousseau's Emile. Rousseau wanted a system of public instruction by the state. He prescribed many years with an unmarried tutor who would withdraw the child as much as possible from parents and relatives. Now, does anybody recognize that form of education? Does anybody recognize the form of education where the state pays for it? Does anybody recognize that? Does anybody recognize a system of education where you remove the child from the parents as early as possible? Anybody see compulsory attendance laws? By the way, the last 30 years or so, there's been 30 to 40 states that have widened the compulsory attendance law in our state. It's been done twice in the last 6 or 7 years. Thankfully, homeschooling has been exempted because of some hard work on the part of some homeschoolers who care for parental rights. Nobody else cares anymore. But Jean-Jacques Rousseau's agenda was to bring compulsory attendance laws to bear to get those children away from those parents as early as possible. Now, what you need to know about Jean-Jacques Rousseau is he had 5 children, and the day each of his children were born, he deposited them on the steps of an orphanage and left them to die there, sometimes in the middle of winter. So he was a madman. One of his live-in girlfriends called him a madman, an interesting madman. After he died, he was insane. He was out of his mind, which, by the way, almost every one of the men who constructed the modern world were insane. And some of them were clinically insane. Darwin, Nietzsche, and probably Rousseau were clinically insane. The father of modern philosophy, Friedrich Nietzsche, modern psychology, he's referred to by Freud and Skinner and others as their father, as their grandfather, as the man. He called himself the first psychologist. He went completely insane. So I think this is very instructive. It's one of the most amazing ironies in all of history. But Jean-Jacques Rousseau was an insane man. And this insane man came up with the ideas that run the modern world. Now, again, you know, why do the billions and billions of people follow him? Why does John Dewey say that it was Jean-Jacques Rousseau that had the most influence upon him? And John Dewey is the man who establishes modern education. And there are thousands and hundreds of thousands of American Christians who teach in the schools, participate in Dewey's system, and they send their children to these schools when the ideologues that put together this system were madmen, insane men, who historians know, there's no question about it. They in some cases starved their children to death, in other cases abandoned their children on the steps of orphanages, and sometimes even forced their wives to abort their children against the wishes of their wives. Okay, these are the madmen who constructed the modern world. You need to read my book, Apostate. I think it's a very important apologetic against what is going on, the ideas that run our world today. But Jean-Jacques Rousseau is leading the pack. There's no question in my mind that Rousseau is the most influential man for the side of evil that has lived in the last 200 to 300 years. And he was, as I said, a madman. In the beginning of his book, Emile, he speaks on the best book ever written on education, which is Plato's Republic. And if you read Plato's Republic, you know that Plato constructed a social system whereby a man and a woman come together for a temporary liaison. They do not get married. They have a baby. The baby comes out of the womb and pops into the hands of professionals, and they take over from there. Thank you very much. And according to Plato, no son shall know his father, and no father shall know his son. And I think you need to focus on that statement, because that effectively summarizes the humanist worldview, where he kills his relationship with God, and then he kills his most important relationships with his brothers, as Cain did when he killed his brother and then wandered east of Eden as a vagabond in the earth. And effectively what the modern world is a great exemplification of the Cain approach to life, becoming the vagabond, building the anonymous city, and not really dealing with relationships anymore. So, friends, it all started with Rousseau, who tried to emulate this great vision that he got from this great philosopher who came up with the idea of destroying marriage and the family. And then we come to Karl Marx, who is another very important man in changing the entire socioeconomic fabric of the day. Now, I'm building this case for what I believe to be a biblical approach to economy, but I'm dealing with the men who put together the world you find out there today. Men like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Rousseau, Plato, and Karl Marx, who wrote the most influential document of the 19th century, the Communist Manifesto. Now, as you read the Communist Manifesto, you're going to find some interesting things. It doesn't say, you know, kill 200 million people, kill a billion people. Ultimately, that's what happens. But what it does do is it lays out a different economic vision. And the economic vision is focused on the issue of the family. In fact, it's focused right in the middle of the Communist Manifesto. Has anybody heard of the Communist Manifesto, by the way? It is by far the most influential document in the last 200 years. So you probably should read it sometime. But right smack in the middle of the Communist Manifesto are these words: abolish home education, replace home education with social. Okay? Homeschoolers are really the target of Karl Marx. This is really the thing he's going after, I think, more than anything else. Now, that might be debatable, but that is certainly the core of the document of the Communist Manifesto. This is the very beginning of communism and Marxism and the slaughter of hundreds of millions of people. It starts with an attack on home education. I kid you not, you are mentioned in the Communist Manifesto. This usually excites homeschool audiences to realize that they're so famous and that Karl Marx took the time to mention them, because it's not a very long document. It's very, very short. Yet right in the middle of the Communist Manifesto is a target. And the target is home education. Home education. Why? Because Karl Marx understands something. He knows that we must abolish the family. Abolish the family. Now, what he says is, when I say abolish the family, some think that this is a radical statement. He says, but don't worry about it. The capitalists have been doing it for a long time by way of taking children away from the parents and the family economy and putting them in the large capitalist corporations. So if the capitalists can do it, we'll do the same thing. That's effectively the argument of the Communist Manifesto, something that most people don't understand. But the focus is not necessarily home education. The focus is not home education. The focus is the home economy. You see, what happened in the 19th century was children were taken away from the family and placed in the corporation. And then the second step was the children were taken out of the corporation and placed under the government by way of child labor laws and the compulsory attendance laws that came from who? Everybody say it. Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Does everybody understand what I just did? Children were taken. By the way, John G. Payton, in his autobiography, you need to read it, in the first page of his autobiography, he said, this is what is going on. He says, children and family farms and family businesses are dissolving right now. It will do immeasurable harm to the world economy in the world in the years to come. John G. Payton, one of the most righteous, one of the most brave, courageous, fantastic missionaries who has lived in the last 200 years, nailed it. He understood what was going on. Very few people do today. But the damage it has done to the family, immeasurable. Immeasurable. Now, if their agenda was to abolish the family. Weaken the family. Now, why would they want to weaken the family? But that's the vision of Plato and Marx and Rousseau, is that the social systems by which man operates will be every individual person plugged into the gigantic totalitarian Orwellian state. That's the goal. And they do not want children connected to families and families connected to churches, because these are relational units. Does anybody on welfare enjoy a very warm relational experience with Barack Obama? Do they? No, they don't. This is because people are living the life of Cain. And friends, they've been so successful, incredibly successful. In 1960, when my father was teaching in the public schools, there were 6% of kids born outside of wedlock, born without fathers, 6%. Today it's 42%, and 50% of children born to women less than 30 years of age are born out of wedlock. Half of marriages end in divorce. And the nuclear family, mom, dad, kids, make up less than half of American households as of 2007. He made it. He did it. He accomplished it. Karl Marx, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, Plato, they did it. Yes, it took 150 years. In the case of Plato, 2,400 years. But they did it. They did it. They accomplished it. Amazing. This is truly amazing. The transitions that have occurred. I mean, they ought to amaze you. You ought to look at this and say, wow, we have never seen these things happen in the history of mankind. And it's happening not just in some small city-state. It might have happened in Sparta. You know, it might have happened for 50 years in Sparta to a population of 3,000. I'm talking about populations of billions, billions of people. People used to ask me, when I was student body president, I came back from Japan and I got into junior college and off to the big university, ran for student body president and won 16,000 students. I had a pretty significant impact for a number of years in student politics and media throughout the entire Central Coast of California. There's a lot of neat things going on. And people used to come to me and say, you were homeschooled. What about socialization? And I used to think that's a stupid question. You know, here I am. I'm making an impact. I have relationships with people all over that campus. I tell you, it didn't matter what club it was. I was there. Minority clubs, even the communist club. I went down and talked to those guys for a little bit. I went all over campus. And I made friends everywhere. I had all kinds of acquaintances. And some geek comes up to me, sticks a microphone in my mouth and says, what about socialization? I couldn't believe it. I thought, that's a crazy, stupid question to ask me. But ultimately, it's not. And it dawned on me later, it is actually an intelligent question, because here's the deal. If you are a sociologist and you're experimenting with children, wouldn't it be strange if you said, okay, 99% of American children are shuffled into large classrooms where they are processed in order to make them good citizens in the state to be properly herded about by socialists and totalitarians? And what if some parents said, I'm not going to do that for the next 18 years of my kid's life? Is that a different social environment? You don't have to be a sociologist to answer this question. Okay? You just say, yeah, it's a little weird. And you know what? Even as I came back from the mission field and I was involved in everything, I always felt like a little bit of the odd man out. I didn't feel like I functioned exactly the same way everybody else did. I just felt like I was weird. And maybe that's just me. But you take a child out of a socialist environment and you say, hey, let's put them with their parents for 18 years. Is that different? Is that a different environment? Of course it is. Of course it is. And your children are going to be different. So, you know, adjust to that fact that your children will be different if you take them out of this social situation that Marx and Dewey call social schools. They call them social schools. Dewey said purpose of education isn't academic, it's to properly socialize. And so when you have people say, you homeschool, what about socialization? They're saying exactly what John Dewey is saying. Education is not about academics. Do you understand? You just read John Dewey, he'll tell you. Education is not about academics. Education is about socialization. So if you take your kids out of the schools and somebody asks you, what about socialization? They're asking the obvious question. The obvious question. Because the whole reason why you do the public schools is to properly socialize them in those schools. And this is why that German family had four kids confiscated. Just last week, the gendarmes broke down the door, came in, grabbed the kids, and said, "You will not see these children for a long time." That's the quote I read from Mike Ferris's. But why would they do that? Because they are utterly committed to John Dewey's agenda, which is to properly socialize 97% of the children, and who cares about the 3%? Except for the fact that maybe God can do something with them. So if you take your kids out of the socialist schools and you do something different with them, you're rearranging the first social domino in a series of dominoes. And if that happens, do you think that that might affect other parts of that child's life? Do you think if you change the way you do family, it might affect the way that you do church? This is a no-brainer. This is a total no-brainer. If kids are used to sitting in classrooms with other kids their own age, 40 to 50 of them, with a teacher up front, and they come to church and they do not find this, they will freak out. Sunday school must look like day school for people who have been properly socialized in day school. You see, if you change the first social domino, will it affect any other social domino in that child's life? Why is it that quote-unquote family-integrated churches are going to be largely homeschool churches? Why? It's a no-brainer, guys. If you affect the first domino, it will affect the other dominoes in your child's life. So when I get the opportunity to exempt myself from Social Security, and I got the opportunity to do so, as a pastor gets a little bit of income, there's a few exemptions left on Social Security. If you're an Amish, I guess you can exempt yourself. If you're a Baptist or something, I guess you're going to have to go buy the hat and be a Baptist Amish and exempt yourself. And there's people ask me, is there any way I can get out of it? Become a Baptist Amish or a Presbyterian Amish. You got to wear the hat. But so there are exemptions. I got an opportunity to exempt myself for a little pastoral income. I can't exempt everything, but I can exempt a little bit because I'm one of the elders in our church that this gets a little bit of double honor. So about 10 years ago, I get the form. Can't remember which form it is. So I'm sitting there looking at the form and I'm saying, yeah, baby, sign it away. I didn't even think twice. I'm like, get me the form. Somebody give me the phone. I gotta sign that thing. You know, why I'm so motivated to sign the form, but that I don't need the government to take care of me. Now, I understand it's not the testimony of everybody. And I'm okay with that. I don't impose this on everybody. I don't. And when we talk about family economies, this is the beginning of the family economy discussion. When we talk about family economies, everybody's going to handle this differently, and people are going to take different steps towards realizing the biblical vision for economics and family economics. So please, understand, there's liberty here. I'm trying to give you a little vision. I'm telling you, this is my path up this hill, and my very first step was grabbing that form and exempting myself, baby, from any kind of Social Security, because I could care less. And even if I'm giving up the $72,000 I paid in when I was working as an engineer for 10 years or whatever, who cares? Exempt the whole thing. Don't need your money. Probably won't be there anyway for me in 2040, and who cares? I don't need Barack Obama. I don't need to nestle up to the breast of big government. I just don't need it. Why? Because I've been raised by a family. Okay? I've been homeschooled. Now, many of you have not been homeschooled. This is my experience. My parents said we don't need the government to take care of us. This is the environment I was raised in. Every day, my parents fed me, my parents educated me, and so when I get the opportunity to sign away Social Security, I did it in a heartbeat because I didn't need it. and I have 5 Social Security programs anyway, and we have a great relationship, and I love my kids, and they love me. You understand? I don't ever need Social Security. I don't need it. I don't want it. I don't need it. I have a family. I have a family. That's my testimony. Then a couple of years ago, I got a little concerned that Barack Obama might be elected as president of the United States. This was prior to 1996, or somewhere around 95, 96. Now, I get concerned that Barack Obama might be elected as president of the United States. And he had committed himself to restoring the inheritance tax, which we had a 1-year exemption on thanks to George W. Bush. The one good thing that George W. Bush did, he was opposed to the death tax somewhat and gave a 1-year reprieve for anybody who died that year, but I couldn't schedule my death that year, so it didn't work. And so here's Barack Obama running for government, and he's saying, I am utterly committed to bringing inheritance taxation back. He wasn't raised by a father, neither was Clinton, and for the most part, our future presidents and leaders will be from dysfunctional families. Please understand that. And functional families generally will be persecuted by dysfunctional families. That's just the way it's going to be. And here is Barack Obama saying, I am utterly committed to destroying the family. Who needs the family? Who needs fathers? In fact, that's what the Barack Obama administration just said in a court case in which they were arguing for lesbian parenting, and the whole case was based on the idea of who needs fathers? And doesn't that make sense with Barack Obama as president of the United States? Who needs fathers? Who needs families? Tax the living daylights out of inheritance. Get those kids away from those parents. Build up the social security systems. Build up the social welfare systems. Do everything you can possibly do to undermine fatherhood. In 1960, there were 25% of inner city kids born outside of wedlock among some minorities. 25%, not nearly high enough. Government comes in with the social welfare programs and they ratchet it up to 72% in order to utterly devastate a humongous population in America to the shame of the Church of Jesus Christ, to our governments, our social systems. And friends, by God's grace, we're going to salvage some of these boys. Somebody say amen to that. We absolutely better. We open up our mentorship centers, our shepherd centers. I've been mentoring sons of single moms for the last 5 years out of my life. In my house, they have eaten thousands of meals in my home because we are going to salvage the years the locusts have eaten. We'll do it case by case by case, but let me tell you this. I don't think I can salvage 72% of what the Democrats, the liberals, the socialists, the Rousseauians, and the Marxists have done to tens of millions of little boys and girls. It is devastating, devastating. Until we bring back private welfare, private charity amongst our churches, and we challenge them not to take the stolen redistributed wealth and to get away from Rousseau and Marx as fast as they possibly can, there won't be any salvaging of these people. They have to stop killing their babies, they have to stop stealing other people's money, and they have to stop fornicating and breaking the seventh commandment too. And that message has got to be worked in the fiber of every single inner city family we can get a hold of. I know I'm off topic for just a second, but it has been devastating. It has been devastating. So, all that said, I said, okay, if Barack Obama gets elected, and if the trajectory is where I think it's going for the next 20, 30, 40 years, because things are 6 or 7 times worse than they were in the 1960s, 1970s, when Barack Obama and others were born, and it's just, things are going to be 6 or 7 times worse in 2030 than they are today in terms of our social systems. So if I want to salvage an inheritance for my children's children, what do I do? That's what a good man does. I found out there was a gift tax exemption for anybody who'd like to pass on money to their kids. The cap was $11,000. For average ordinary guys like me, that's plenty enough. $11,000 a year per kid. I said, praise God. We made up a little bit of money. We were able to save a little bit of capital after being taxed on this and taxed on that and taxed on capital gains and tax on. We were able to save a little money. And I said, instead of government coming at the end and saying, hey, we're taking 84% of that, thank you very much, I'm going to right away take some of my savings and give it to my daughters. My son, he's going to be working hard to try to cut a piece of the rock out for himself, and we'll probably get something to him on his wedding day. But I started my oldest daughter, probably 14 years of age, writing money into the CDs to her name and passing on X number of thousands of dollars per year to Emily, cut Rebecca in 2 years later, cut Bethany in 2 years ago, we'll cut Abigail in probably in another 2 years from now. And so piece by piece by piece, we're moving our inheritance onto our children. Why? Because we are going to have a family in the year 2030, and the socialist state, by God's grace, will not destroy my heritage and my family. And I know that we have trillions of dollars in all the powerful institutions in the world focused on destroying our marriages, our family economies, our family inheritance, and everything that God considers to be precious. But I believe that God is going to carve out a little island of freedom for homeschooling here, little island of freedom of gift tax exemption inheritance here, little island of freedom for medical care over here in the Obamacare bill where those Christian medical sharing ministries were exempted. God is finding little nooks and crannies in which we will operate within this macroeconomy on this Titanic that as a ship is going down, the life raft manufacturing centers are booming. We're building life rafts like crazy. And there's hope. And something's happening. And I'm like thrilled out of my pants. We're talking about oikonomia. By the way, when we did this thing, I brought all my kids together. Said, okay, kids, we wrote off Social Security. It's not helping us. I'm giving away. I got a little panicky that day. I was writing checks and, getting rid of our savings for when mom and dad are old and decrepit and can't take care of themselves. And so I said, kids, let's turn to Matthew chapter 15. We were in Bible time. We're going to do something different today. We're going to go to Matthew chapter 15. Matthew chapter 15, Jesus is condemning the Pharisees because the Pharisees came up with this wonderful idea called Korban, where you can write all of your taxes or your gifts to the temple as a temple tax, and then you didn't have any responsibility to take care of your parents in their old age. And Jesus came to these Pharisees, you dirty, rotten Pharisees! You displaced my law. You made my law of none effect by your stupid Social Security Korban program. Shame on you. The laws of God said honor your mother and father even in their old age. So, kids, we're going to come to live with you. Basically. Big group hug. We're building family economies. Family economies. And I know that this is an affront to feminism. The feminists hate me. Can't really understand that. I'm a nice guy, you know? But I picked this up because I have a radio show, and I got 15 nastagrams in the last 24 hours. And I think I got one person saying, I kind of like you guys. A lot of people hate what we say. I don't get it, except for maybe they just don't like God's law. I think God's law is great. I do. I honestly don't think tyranny is that good. Everybody seems to like it. I don't. Anybody here not like tyranny? Anybody in Texas not like tyranny? I don't like tyranny. But the feminists love it. Gloria Steinem says, the liberated woman has sex before marriage and a job after. It's all about the job. And these are the great leaders of the feminist movement. Betty Friedan is the other one. She's the major thinker of feminism. And because most Christian women are feminists today, I hate to say it, but they are. They just think like feminists. That's just because, you know, the zeitgeist just kind of seeps in on your skin for 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100 years. It just, that kind of does. I'm sorry, it just does. It's really, really difficult to get people to say, you know, I think we are a little feminist in our thinking. But here's what, I mean, this is the very core of feminist ideologies. Now, today, feminists get a little more radical. They say, we must destroy marriage. Actually, Gloria Steinem said that a number of times. So, we must destroy marriage. They say that all the time. And now they're saying, we must kill and murder and eliminate as many males as possible. A 90-10 ratio is good of females to males. That's what they're saying now. So just understand, the feminist ideology is very, very strong. They're epistemologically self-conscious. They know what they're doing. But Betty Friedan would say, if a woman has a choice between competing with her own husband in the home and competing in the marketplace, she should choose the latter. Everybody understand? She's giving you a choice. She's saying, compete with your husband in the home or compete in the marketplace. She should compete in the marketplace. The whole assumption behind feminism is that there is no unified family economy. The axe head does not go on the axe handle. The male and the female do not come together. The female as a helpmeet for the male. But it is rather a bunch of handles and heads running around society trying to get some things done. Does that make sense, anybody? The biblical construct of the family as an economy is that the wife is a help appropriate for her husband as an axe head is on an axe handle. If you put the axe head on the axe handle, you chop down more trees than if you dink away with the head all day long, or take a handle and whack trees as hard as you can for like a year and a half. Okay, is that clear? The axe head on the axe handle, God's idea, complementary, slightly different roles. This is anathema. Because why? Because ultimately socialists and humanists are Cain. And they hate marriage, they hate the family, and that's fundamental to the breakdown of the family and the marriage in the feminist ideology. Well, the results of what these feminists have desired, of course, have come to pass. The males are no longer responsible for the material well-being of the home, 1 Timothy 5:8. Women are no longer complementary to the males in the work that they do. And so we get what we get. We get 70 to 80% of young men not grown up by 30 years of age, up from 30% in 1970 per Newsweek magazine 2 years ago. And by the way, that'll be 80 to 90% in the years to come. Why? Because generally speaking, boys feel themselves to be useless. They are disenfranchised in education, and it's a 60-40 split for girls to boys in college, and twice as many 23-year-old girls have degrees as 23-year-old boys. Twice as many now. And here's the kicker. The millennial generation, according to Pew Research, came out just a month ago or so, treated on my radio show. Pew Research, millennial generation, 61% of households now of the millennial generation provided for by the woman as the major breadwinner, and 17% provided for by man as the major breadwinner. Friends, it's done. They've accomplished their goal. This is what they want. Men, the end of men, the demise of guys. These are the books they write. It's over. This is Atlantic Magazine. This is Newsweek. This is Time. It's done. People have asked, what does the next generation look like? There will be none. There will be none. There will be no fathers to speak of. I'm talking about the macro. Again, I'm talking about the Titanic. I'm not talking about the emergency raft manufacturing centers. I'm talking about the Titanic. You don't get another generation. You understand? You don't get it. You don't get it in birth implosion. You don't get it in character. You don't get it in fatherhood. You don't get it in work. And yes, the worker-to-retiree ratio will be one-third of what it was 50 years ago. 10 years from now, one-third. And there will be 80 million retiring baby boomers. And 2011 was the first time the Social Security Fund went into the red. And the character of the nation is one-tenth of what it was in 1940 and 1950 when boys knew how to get their pants on straight and go to college and do something and build an empire. Guys, it's over. It's done. The millennial generation, according to Time Magazine, the most narcissistic, laziest generation ever. According to Atlantic Magazine, the millennial generation is the unluckiest generation, starting with less capital, less income than any generation, at least in the past 2 to 3 generations, silence, etc. And you say, the worker to retiree ratio is 1/3 of what it was 50 years ago, 20 years from now? What in the world is going to happen when 80 million baby boomers are playing golf and the rest of the 20-something boys are playing computer games in their parents' basements? Does anybody understand economics here? Does anybody know what happens to a society like this? Does anybody know what happens? Friends, the good times are over. They're over. I mean, I'm reading statistics not from some right-wing magazine. It's just the stuff that's out there. This is the society constructed by Betty Friedan, the feminists, and others, the socialists, the Marxists. And people wonder why I won't soften the rhetoric. Guys, why? Why? Would you soften the rhetoric if you've hit the iceberg and the ship's tipping like 45 degrees? And you're going to soften the rhetoric? You want me to soften the rhetoric? You want me to say, oh, I guess we better mosey for the life rafts now? I'm not going to do that. At least for the people who have ears to hear. The people understand we cannot continue the way we've been going. Let me give you the most controversial question I ask at homeschooling conferences. This gets me disinvited from pretty much every single homeschool conference. And I know I get into a homeschool conference, I get one shot. So I usually ask the one controversial question. And it's a very honest question. It's a question any sociologist would ask. I don't think I'm breaking God's law. I'm not even breaking any social standards by asking a question. I'm just asking a question. Why do homeschooling moms come home to prepare their daughters to leave home? That's the question. It's an honest question. There's nothing wrong with asking that question. Why do homeschooling moms come home? And they do come home. And God bless them. They are trying to strive and to struggle to create something. Why do homeschooling moms come home to prepare their daughters to leave home? And the answer is very simple. They know they're not stupid. Homeschooling moms aren't stupid. They know that 70%, no, 80% of young men are not grown up by 30 years of age, up in 30% in 1970. They know that. They're not stupid. You say, well, how in the world are we going to solve that problem? They'll tell you, there is no solution. The best shot we have is to get our daughters into the workplace and salvage the last 17% of the population that will have some kind of mom that is providing for those households. But here's the problem. If you've got a 64% of moms who are leaving their kids under 6 in a latchkey condition, and that's producing 70 to 80% of young men not grown up by 30 years of age, 30% in 1970, what's going to happen when all the homeschoolers run out into the marketplace? And now, 85% of little boys and girls are raised in latchkey condition under 6 years of age. That will produce 95% of young men not grown up by 30 years of age, up to 30% in 1970. The spiral continues, and the spiral continues, and the spiral continues until we do something radical. I know this is a challenge, but you got to do something radical. You say, what? Well, let me just say this very simply. I know I don't have much more time. Very simply, a recipe for disaster is to bring a little 6- and 7-year-old boy home, give him 4 to 5 to 6 hours of boring homework, schoolwork, in any given day, and then let him play computer games for the rest of the 5 to 6 hours per day until he's 18 years of age and see how that works out. Does everybody here understand that's a recipe for disaster? You say, well, what in the world do you do with a 6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or 10-year-old boy? What did they do for 5,930 years? In 1930, 70% of 15-year-old boys were working in some kind of a family farm. Today it's 0.5%. this is the simplest way I can present it. And you thought it was going to be more complicated than this, didn't you? It's not complicated at all. It's a little bit difficult because fathers have to get a vision. Because moms are doing everything they can. But until dads say, we have got to build a family economy in this house. It's not about, here, mom, just do homeschooling and let the kid play computer games and keep him busy the rest of the day. I'm sorry, that's not going to salvage Western civilization. Dads are going to have to get a vision for a family economy. Now, that does not mean that dads have to come home right away from work and build an entrepreneurial effort, et cetera, et cetera. We do not call our conferences entrepreneurial conferences because entrepreneurism is about 20% of the vision. The other 80% is everything I've already talked about: inheritance, Social Security, taking care of your parents in their old age. We have whole divisions now of our FamilyEconomics.com website that are going to be devoted to caring for the elderly and bringing the 90 million retiring baby boomers who will probably be euthanized generally into relational homes and establishing relational, wonderful elderly care systems. And we've done radio programs on this, and we have a meeting happening in November in my house for the first time. We have midwifery programs right now. We have the first Christian midwifery training program on site in America that started in my basement about 9 months ago, and was again back in my basement for a retreat about a week ago, and we're building midwifery, we're building relational family businesses where you can care for the elderly yourself and not revert them into an institutionalized Social Security driven euthanasia mill sort of thing. That's got to happen in our present society. I can't think of any other option economically, politically, morally, etc., etc. We're headed that direction, no question in my mind. No, family economies are a bust. At this point, it's family economies or a bust. It's family economies or euthanize your kids. It's family economies or forced abortions by way of forced Obamacare approach that doesn't allow for parental decisions in the case of Down syndrome kids conceived in the womb. Okay, it's going to be forced abortions. It's going to be forced euthanasia. It's going to be little boys not growing up with strong character, and little girls, what do you do with little girls? I could go on and on with what to do with our girls. What do you do with our girls? What do you do? Family economies. Family economies. Family economies. About 6 or 7 or 8, 10 years ago, we started a family economy. We just started it. Started it up. I was working in the corporate world. I had my typical corporate job, as everybody does. We were working hard to pay off our house and try to get on with things. And God has enabled us in so many different ways. We just got the vision for the family economies. Now people come up and say, are you a one-income family or two-income family? I tell them, I'm a seven-income family. We're a 10-income. I think we're 10-income. I have the spreadsheet, everything. We got so much going on. Just 2 days ago, I was at home. We had a 16-hour day, and it was like at the end of the day, my wife and I looked at us, and we just collapsed in bed because it's amazing the kind of stuff going on in our home. And our children have their own little efforts going here and there, and it doesn't stop. The whole idea of the family economy is based in oikonomia. The Greek word oikonomia, oikos, is family. Nomia is law or vision. The family economy has always been the basic economic unit since the beginning of time. The fourth commandment. Has anybody heard of the Ten Commandments here? Do you get the Ten Commandments down in Texas? Okay, the fourth commandment, very basic. It's been around for a long, long, long time. You shall work 6 days, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your what? Son, nor your daughter, nor your son, nor your daughter. It made it into the fourth commandment. This is gone. What? My seven-year-old working? What? You say, well, how does my seven-year-old work when dad's working? Go build birdhouses. Have him build 100 of them. Paint them red, green, blue, etc., and flood the bird market, the birdhouse market in San Antonio. I don't care. You have mud down here in Texas? Have them shape paperweights out of mud. Put them in the oven. Sell them for 10 cents. I don't care. When the pilgrims came to America, there weren't any jobs, but there was a lot of work to do. Get it? There weren't any jobs, and there's a lot of work to do. Go out there. There's work to do. And when we come to our family economics conferences, there are thousands of ideas. We have panels of families doing amazing things, breaking off pieces of the economy, and it's unstoppable right now. It's incredible. I think God is salvaging our future economies by way of the family economy. Alan Carlson talks about the history of family economies in his recent book. He's a Hillsdale College economist. And he talks about G.K. Chesterton and Hilaire Belloc, in 1920, they were saying capitalism and communism are inherently unstable systems. They will break down families, break down societies, and thereby break down economies. They said the only possibility of salvaging the modern world, these are brilliant Christian writers from the 1920s, will be in the reestablishing of family economies. And Alan Carlson talks about four experiments that have been done. All of them have failed, with the exception of the homeschooling movement in America. And the main reason they failed is because they didn't get the first domino right. They didn't get the kids out of the public schools. Until we can reintegrate the family by way of education, we cannot reintegrate the family in the area of economics. And as we integrate the family in the way of economics, friends, I think we can salvage the Western world. I think we'll salvage our future civilizations. And it's happening everywhere. There's a mom out in Oregon. I interviewed her on my show. It's an amazing story. The family does all kinds of things. They have seven incomes. And they have two special needs kids, severely special needs kids. They have a band. They have a family band with the special needs kids doing the little rattle thing. Amazing family. The mom's a dermatologist. They have a dermatologist business where the kids do the work, the father administrates, and mom works 20 hours a week as part of the team. See, again, you're saying, oh, are you saying that moms can't do work? Proverbs 31 says moms do all kinds of work. And the idea that homeschooling ought to dominate 80 to 90% of our time in a day, that doesn't sound like Proverbs 31 to me. It seems to me that's a little more life integrated in a concept of Proverbs 31. Proverbs 31 does say the heart of her husband does safely trust in her. It doesn't say the heart of her corporate boss safely trusts in her. It doesn't say the heart of the hospital administration where she makes $65,000 a year plus $20,000 of benefits from Obamacare, because again, we're passing our women from the home economy into the capitalist economies on into the government. This is the process. This process for kids is happening with women now. Same kind of thing. We're slowly moving towards a fascist-driven Obamacare system where women are carefully taken from the home into the corporate world and then passed off to Obamacare and to the political socialist state. Okay? That's what's happening with our women now. But it says the heart of her husband does safely trust in her so that he shall have no need to spoil. Why? Because they are a team. Because she is part of his family economy. And this is the way the world went for 5,940 years until Betty Friedan and Karl Marx showed up. I know this is a little bit of a shift in the way we look at our family economies. But I want to challenge you to this. Build your family economy. People say, how much of a family economy is a family economy? The first step is for you to see that you've got a family economy. It's not a one income, it's not a two income, it's a seven income that flows into one income. On our computer, it happens on one spreadsheet. It's a family. We take care of each other. We take care of our parents in their old age. We don't rely on socialist systems to provide for us. God, I believe, is going to preserve somebody out of the milieu, out of the destruction, out of the chaos of what happens when a Titanic hits the big one. God is going to preserve a remnant. I can see it. I can see it so clearly. With our culture self-destructing, I've been following culture and pop music for the last 35 years since I was a DJ back in the 1980s. Friends, it's not just Kurt Cobain doing his self-destructive nihilism. That was 30% of pop music, and he committed suicide, of course, in 1993. Today, I just checked it. The five top, one number one, two number two, number three, number four, number five songs are self-consciously decadent and nihilist more than anything I have ever seen in my life by a long shot. We are 80 to 90% suicidal in our culture, up from about 25 to 30%. We have crossed over from decadence to nihilism. It's happening, but God will protect our children who unplug those iPods and sit around the piano and play hymns and psalms and sing every evening. We will see that there will be some children that will not commit cultural suicide in the year 2030. We will have children that will have some healthy sexual relationships, and they will be having children. They will have true families. They will have a social system. They will have economies. God is preserving our families, our marriages, our economics, our sexuality, our teleology, our purpose for life, our joy, our motivation to get out there and do something for the kingdom of God. There will be a remnant in the midst of the destruction of the postmodern age. And much of it will come about by way of the family economy. You can grab a whole compendium of about 45 talks on family economics at our table, right out back. Again, I couldn't do the whole thing today. Couldn't do 45 hours in 1 hour. But try to get more on this. It's beautiful. I mean, it's happening. It's incredible. Some of the happiest families, most productive. Our debt-free ratio, we do little audience response units. When we get 2,000 or 3,000 people down to our humongous conferences, we bust out. We had a conference that filled up just a week ago, 2 months before the conference happened. We busted it out to 1,050 out in Washington. People understand that this is what God is going to use. He's going to get back to a biblical family economic vision in order to salvage our civilizations in years to come. So look into this, visit familyeconomics.com, visit our table out back, and that's all the time I have. Thank you.